She's just kind of an all-American girl.
I was shocked beyond belief. It's not that it's so easy to remember. It's just that it's so hard to forget.
Was there some double life? Was she involved in something no one knew about?
Everything that she ever did in her life, she became obsessed with.
One of the amazing things about the medical examiner's job is that you see the bad side of everybody, all the dirty stuff that they didn't want people to know about.
Every murder is a mystery. But a victim's body is a sea of evidence. Every fiber is a clue. Every wound, a piece of the puzzle. The medical examiner holds the key to unlock their stories and catch a killer. This is Secrets of the Morgue.
Mobile is a wonderful city. If you had to describe it in one word, friendly would be a very applicable description.
The University of South Alabama is academically a very tough school to go to.
Crimes just didn't occur as often as in other parts. They had security guards who wrote some parking tickets, and that was basically it.
One Saturday morning, staff and students come together for something much darker than academics.
It was spread everywhere that this particular student, Catherine Foster, was missing.
Catherine Foster is a great student, very respected, very popular.
The Mobile police got involved, the campus government got involved, and so they've got people from all over the campus who joined together and just did a walkover of the campus. And they started close around where Catherine normally was, her room, her dorm area, and then expanded from there.
There was a wooded area several hundred yards from the dorms.
150 feet from the paved road, one of the participants saw something ahead as they were walking and got fairly close and realized it was a body. One of the friends identified her. This is Catherine. She just looked like she had walked out there and laid down on the ground. It's one of those things that just sticks with you. It's not that it's so easy to remember. It's just that it's so hard to forget. This is a 18-year-old female on the campus of the University of South Alabama, and now she's laying here dead. Why?
Detective Williams works with Dr. Gary Cumberland to help discover what happened to Catherine Foster.
Ironically, I was at our facility here at the campus. I was actually doing my fellowship in forensics. My supervisor at the time was Dr. Leroy Riddick.
Dr. Riddick takes the lead as medical examiner on the case, with Dr. Cumberland assisting.
Dr. Riddick and I both had this compulsion to do a good job on everything we did and be thorough.
One of Dr. Riddick's principles was absolutely do not touch the body. So no one had touched the body. No one had moved it.
She was laying on her back. Immediately, it was obvious that she'd had two gunshot wounds to her head. One of them was an indeterminate range gunshot wound, which means that the barrel of the gun was far enough away that there wasn't any powder stippling around it. The other one was a closer range, almost contact wound.
This appears to be a professional hit job.
It's not a robbery. It's not random. It's not spur of the moment in a confrontation. There's a story behind an execution-style killing.
All the reports we had was she was such a fine person, Christian person. She was doing nothing that should have put her in this position, but yet here she is dead.
Catherine is a great student. She's pursuing a physical therapy degree, so she's serious about college and making the most of it. She was very involved in her church. The parents very involved in the local school where they knew everybody.
When a young person goes away to college, they often begin to lead a much more independent life, and parents are often in the dark when it comes to how that person is leading their life. Folks who come from a very strict religious upbringing are often very quick to hide different parts of themselves from their family members.
There was an effort put into trying to really do a good background on Catherine Foster. Was she involved in any at-risk behavior? Was she dealing with drug dealers?
Doctors Riddick and Cumberland begin to analyze Catherine's body, looking for answers.
It's one of the amazing things about the medical examiner's job is that you see the bad side of everybody, all the dirty stuff that they didn't want people to know about. We run toxicology on everybody. If you don't run it, then you don't know whether she is addicted to some certain type of drug, and that was what caused all the involvement.
While investigators await the toxicology results, they interview Catherine's family to uncover a possible motive.
Catherine is the last person her family would ever expect to have someone hate her or to have any kind of conflict that might have led to something like this.
Catherine's friends are also interviewed.
She had her one great friend, Tish, who she knew very well from high school, and her friend, Jamie. But essentially, these young girls living a pretty innocent life. They're worried. They're kind of overwhelmed.
We couldn't establish any criminal contact or anything that would have resulted in some professional hitman coming to Mobile and killing Catherine Foster.
The results from the toxicology tests on Catherine come back.
Her toxicology screen was basically negative. She hadn't been drinking. There are no drugs of abuse in her system, so it tells you that she wasn't under the control of any of illegal substances or alcohol, so you know, she probably had her wits about her when all this occurred.
She had a group of friends, just living a normal life. She was not putting herself in the way of danger. To find her, murder just steps away from her dorm. Just was baffling.
And what was the motive here? This particular one seemed almost motiveless.
Police consider if sexual assault could have been the trigger for this shocking crime.
We start going over the external surfaces to look for any signs of interaction with some force in the environment. Her clothing is not in disarray. There was no evidence that she had had a violent altercation with someone. There was no evidence of any type of sexual involvement.
A model student and perfect daughter vanishes and is then discovered executed. For the detectives, nothing makes sense.
One of the most confusing, one of the most frustrating things about it was to try to figure a motive. But this young lady's life was taken from her in a very brutal way. Somebody should pay for taking Catherine's life.
Detectives can't find a motive in the murder of Catherine Foster. In order to make sense of what little information they have, police focus on when she disappeared.
One of the things that we did, we established a timeline for everybody involved in the case.
They interview Catherine's friends, Tish Consolini and Jamie Kellum.
We had determined that a Thursday morning, Jamie and Catherine, Tissy, they were going grocery shopping.
Catherine and Jamie are to meet Tish at the car.
Jamie reported that Catherine made the statement, "I forgot something. I will go get it, and I will meet you at your car." Jamie tells us that Catherine leaves, and she goes to her car to wait.
Jamie and Tish wait for Catherine to come back, but she never does.
Jamie thinks maybe that Catherine has run up on someone. They've gone here, gone there. There was no sense of worry because it was just campus life.
Remember, this is not the age of a cell phone or the ability to text, so you just kind of had to go with the flow. But as the day goes on, this very responsible straight-A girl misses her 2 o'clock class, which Tish was in. Suddenly, there's a sense of worry of what's going on with Catherine.
Tish called Mr. and Mrs. Foster and said, "Hey, have you heard from Catherine? She's missing. We don't know where she is. We thought maybe she had come home or whatever." And, of course, the parents reported no.
Catherine was last seen on Thursday, 2 days before her body is found.
You usually wait 24 hours before that missing report is actually filed. So that report is not filed until the Friday after she's missing, which led to a lot of the confusion as far as time of death.
Core mystery was time of death. You go down a decision tree, and once you set an estimated time of death, then you work within those parameters.
Dr. Riddick uses a variety of factors to establish her time of death.
He does his examination, again, looking for our classic things, the rigor, the loss of body temperature, looking for any evidence of insect infestation, which usually happens fairly quickly on a dead body. The flies will get on the body almost immediately after death. Flies just look for moisture to lay their eggs. Rigor is one of those things that when you're young and athletic like she was in her early 20s, that tends to be fairly consistent. He said, "Well, you know, we're looking probably at the 8 hours to 20 hours based on the body temperature." She didn't have any of the signs that made us think that it had been an extended period of time.
The timing of Catherine's death raises a new question in the mystery of her murder.
We are looking at a bracket of from Friday morning till Saturday morning to fit the estimated time of death. But then the question was, where had she been since Thursday? Jamie was the last person that reported seeing Catherine Foster.
Police turn to the medical examiner to see if any evidence from the autopsy can point them to who may have killed her.
The entrance wounds were both in the back of her head. There was still enough time for her heart to beat that it allowed the brain to swell up before the second bullet was fired. The fact that the swelling was there is indicative of the fact that she was still alive. Her heart was still beating, was pumping blood before the second bullet was fired. So there was a time interval between the two.
That should be an immediate indicator to you that this is an overkill, because most people will never survive the first gunshot. To me, it generally rings of some intimacy or some familiarity between the victim and the deceased. And that should be the first clue for you as to where you should be looking for a suspect.
The detectives take a hard look at everyone in Catherine's social circle.
Tish is Catherine's closest friend.
She had this alibi that was solid. Where she was, there were witnesses to it.
Well, Jamie's whereabouts was accounted for from the time Catherine went missing until the time her body was found.
Jamie goes to Pascagoula and stays with her family.
Tish and Jamie are ruled out. So the investigator's attention turns to Catherine's love life.
In about half of the cases where a woman is murdered, police know that the primary suspect, the person who is likely behind their killing, is the romantic partner.
She had a boyfriend. Her boyfriend, Tom, was around.
Tom knew Catherine all of his life. There were high school sweethearts and then college sweethearts. But there had been this incident just recently at Mardi Gras where she saw him kiss another girl. But that was certainly a little bit of a flag to investigators.
Detective Williams looks into Tom's activities at the time of Catherine's death.
There were a couple of instances where on the Friday night leading into Saturday morning, it was a six-hour period of time when Tom was not accounted for.
As they question other students, one of them reports a surprising event within that exact span of time.
There was a young lady living on campus that suffered a severe asthma condition. This young lady suffered such an attack that Saturday morning at approximately 2 a.m. And she immediately got up and opened her window. As she pushed her window open, she heard what she thought was two gunshots.
Police press Tom, but he maintains he was alone at the time the shots were reported.
If you don't have a concrete alibi, you offer them the opportunity to take a polygraph.
A polygraph is an electronic analysis of certain bodily functions. They look for the changes in the perspiration, in the respiration, in the body temperature. By and large, they give you a fairly good indication as to whether somebody's been deceptive or not.
Tom failed the polygraph test. But when I looked at the report of the polygraph and he had failed it, I think that his feelings for her and his caring for her is what caused him to fail the polygraph test. There was nothing else beyond the fact that he must have done it because he's the boyfriend.
Tom remains a suspect, but investigators reach out to the public and receive a startling lead.
But they have this father come forward. His story was that his son, who was kind of troubled, obviously had some issues, had left that Thursday, of all things, with a gun. And he was mysteriously gone. He came back, he seemed rattled.
Investigators have a suspect in Catherine Foster's murder. A young man identified by his father for behaving strangely and carrying a .22 caliber handgun.
The gun seemed to fit the description of whatever gun had killed Catherine.
If there are bullets retained in the body, that's incredibly good evidence. You can relate it back to the gun that actually caused it, to the exclusion of every gun in the universe. The bullet that was retrieved from her, it was with a .22 caliber bullet. We thought we were home free. We had our man. Each gun has its own set of lands and grooves that twist the bullet as it's coming down the barrel. So when the bullet comes out the end of that barrel, it's being scraped a certain way so that if you put it under a comparison microscope, you have one bullet that you know was shot from that gun, and you have your unknown bullet. You can put them and compare them side by side and say, this is the gun that shot, that fired this bullet.
You have to really admire this father for coming forward and caring enough about the case to want us to speak up, knowing it was his son that he was implicating. But then, happily to realize, once they tested everything, that it was not his son.
The bullets that killed Catherine do not match the young man's gun.
Not being able to reach a firm belief and being able to prove what had happened was so frustrating and disappointing. We certainly had not given up.
With no clear suspects, investigators consider the campus location itself.
We began to look at who has access to the dorms, students, who could move about the campus pretty much unnoticed. And so they began looking at employees of the campus.
They find one with a highly suspicious past.
This particular maintenance man was a National Guardsman. In 1979, this particular suspect tried to abduct a medical student. And when the medical student tried to escape, shot her with an M16. He became such a suspect here in Catherine Foster's homicide.
How was he later hired at a college campus as a maintenance man? That was baffling, but it also tells you about the innocence of Mobile at that time.
She's been missing since Thursday. There was a theory that she had been kidnapped and held against her will, and that the person that had kidnapped her finally realized, oh, what am I going to do?
Detectives turned to the medical examiners for any signs that the maintenance man could have held Catherine against her will.
We look at the body and there are no external signs of being handcuffed or bound in any way. The first thing you think of, obviously, is drugs. You know, something had been given to her to make her compliant. But the absence of drugs eliminates a whole bunch of possibilities.
You can have restraints that consist of a locked room or a locked closet. It doesn't have to be physically applied to the body.
The original theory was that Catherine Foster was imprisoned in a room of some sort, and her clothing at the time that she was found was clean. And so the other theory was that she was kept nude. The reason for the abduction or the attempted abduction of the medical student was sexual assault. The problem I saw with the original suspect on that was there was no sexual assault with Catherine Foster.
We also checked employment record and people that had seen the maintenance worker. He was accounted for most of the hours from Thursday to early Saturday morning. So he had an alibi for that period of time. That kind of took him out of the picture. It was just another one of those leads that withered on the vine and didn't produce anything.
Despite the best efforts of the homicide unit, Catherine's case goes cold.
The hundreds and probably thousands of people that were interviewed, the thousands of miles traveled, the thousands of hours spent investigating it, and regardless of what road we went down, then it ended up being a dead end. If you are a human being with any feelings at all, you want to solve that case.
3 years later, a mysterious fatality gives detectives a break.
We received a call of an unattended death a mile or so from the campus. The person was identified as a security guard employed by the University of South Alabama at the time that Catherine Foster was killed.
The security guard died for almost 3 years to the day after Catherine was killed.
The timing of his death and the fact that he worked on Catherine's campus raises alarms.
No one had seen him at work, and so they went to his house to find out what was wrong with him. And he was in his house, and he was decomposing, so he was dead at that time.
Police identify the man as Michael Maris. His body is sent to the morgue for autopsy.
There was no evidence of trauma to the body, and so you automatically start thinking what else causes death in someone who's a relatively young individual like this. An overdose of medication of some sort or a poison is number one on your hit list. We draw the toxicology, we draw blood, we draw urine, vitreous fluids, anything that we can get.
As police process the crime scene, they make a startling find.
One of the most prominent things that we observed was a copy of Catherine's autopsy report. Mr. Maris had secured that from the University of South Alabama Medical Center, and in the margins were handwritten notes apparently made by Mr. Maris, comments about what that said.
Killers who are obsessed with their own work are often narcissists. Sometimes they have this sense of gratification that comes with knowing that the public is still confused as to what happened.
When investigators move through the rest of the house, they find a number of disturbing clues.
We found an area that had been fenced off with what we know as chicken wire. And inside this, there was a mattress, some sheets, a pillow.
That kind of fit the theory. Catherine was kept somehow imprisoned away from campus for 24 to 36 hours. There's this almost a shrine about Catherine Foster's homicide, pornography, and, you know, the sex dolls.
There was kind of this assumption that Michael Maris, he had this terribly guilty conscience, and he had committed the crime, never got over it.
Detectives looked to Dr. Cumberland to confirm their suspicion about Michael Maris.
We opened up his stomach and looked at his gastric contents. There was just a whole handful of undissolved medicine in his stomach. And so we classified it as a suicide due to the overdose of his medicine. We thought we found our man. He's killed her. He feels guilty about it. He knows he's going to get caught. He's committed suicide.
Investigators feel they are closing in on Catherine Foster's killer, suicidal security guard Michael Maris. Now they need to prove it.
He was uniformed. He was armed. He could possibly have had access to a security guard car. He could have exploited his position to effect the capture or the taking of Catherine. The question was, where was she and where was he in the ensuing hours that led up to 2 a.m. on Saturday morning?
Detective Williams checks Michael Maris's timesheet.
Thursday night, he was on duty, showed up, worked 8 hours, got off Friday morning. He showed up Friday night, worked all night as far as we can determine, and was actually in the presence of a second security guard when we thought the shots were fired that killed Catherine Foster.
The police realize Maris could not be the killer.
Now, then the question became, what was his involvement with the Foster case?
He had applied for a number of police departments, but had been rejected.
He had been turned down because he couldn't pass the psychological tests. And so as a result, he was hoping that if he solved this case, which is the big case in the area, then they would have to hire him and bring him on board.
The final piece of the puzzle is the holding cage found in his apartment.
The grandfather had suffered dementia, and he would wander off into the neighborhood and go missing. Maris had apparently used that area to seclude Granddaddy and keep Granddaddy from wandering off up the street. He committed suicide, his mother committed suicide, and we were able to document 4 other members of the immediate family that had committed suicide.
Michael Maris was troubled, but he wasn't the killer.
We thought we had it, and we didn't. And so it was back to the drawing board and back to square one to try to figure out what we were missing and where we could go from there.
When you see somebody that's that young, that's got their whole life ahead of them, that's involved in absolutely no at-risk behavior whatsoever, to be executed in this manner really drove home a lot of the feelings within homicide detectives, who are usually pretty tough guys. Not only did it affect them, but the generations of homicide detectives that came after the original homicide detectives were completely obsessed with the case. And so there was constantly this review of the case that kept going on.
Catherine Foster's case becomes legendary. 20 years pass with no break or leads. And yet Catherine's mysterious death is never forgotten by the police, the community, or the media.
Amy Greer was a reporter. And we had gotten to be friends over the years with so many cases. Amy approached me one day and said, "We've got this new format. I can do a longer report." And I said, "Well, Amy, if the parents will agree with it, why not put it out there?"
There was this hope that it would jog some memories or a sense of guilt from someone out there. Who knew?
A few days after the program airs, detectives get a tip from a mysterious man named Ricky.
One of his employees had confessed to him that she had killed someone on the campus back in 1980. This person has met Ricky at an AA meeting and formed some type of friendship. One of the things that was interesting is that he, in fact, did not even believe her at first when she's telling him the story. So she had to convince him. She went to the local library and printed out news articles about Catherine's murder in 1980, showed him, said, "This is the girl that I killed. I'm telling you the truth." Part of this AA thing that they were a part of was going through these 12 steps. One of these 12 steps was trying to make amends to the person that you have wronged. If the person that you've wronged is deceased, it's normal to write them a letter.
When investigators ask who the woman is, they are shocked by Ricky's reply.
The name of the suspect was Jamie Letson. In the file, the only name that was close to that was Jamie Kellum. In fact, it was the same person. She had been married and had a new last name at that time.
During the initial investigation of Catherine's murder, Jamie had been cleared of any suspicion, so police are skeptical of Ricky's story.
He has a past himself. He had been arrested for manslaughter, and he had been arrested for perjury, lying.
If you're dealing with a suspect who spent time in jail, you have to be very careful about what they're telling you and why they're telling you. They're not stupid. They've been there before, and they understand how the police work. We used to always say, if a criminal tells you today's Thursday, get out your calendar and have a look.
To confirm Ricky's account, Detective Morgan searches for any evidence that Jamie wrote a confession letter.
I tracked down her stepfather. I knocked on his door, talked to him, and asked if he had ever found a letter written by Jamie concerning Catherine's murder. His response was, "You mean the letter?" So I'm like, "Yes, the letter." And that's when he told me, he said, "Well, I will let you read it for yourself." What Jamie said was that she lured Catherine out into the woods under a false pretense, and that out there, she shot her in the back of the head. When she fell, she said that Catherine was making a noise, so she walked up to her, put the gun to her temple, and shot her at close range. She immediately left the woods, and she went back over to the dorm and threw the gun into a dumpster. And then she just played it off as, "Where's Catherine?" The whole time, Jamie is acting as if nothing had happened.
The letter is a stunning confession, but Jamie's stepfather raises a red flag.
Jamie did have a history of just lying and exaggerating and telling these really crazy, you know, stories. And so it completely destroys the credibility.
It might seem strange to think that anyone would lie about killing another person. But in some social circles, the fact that you've killed someone can become a sign of respect.
Ricky had been involved in a homicide. Because Jamie was such a braggart, it was believed at the time that she was just bragging that she had killed Catherine Foster just to make herself more interesting or more appealing to Ricky. I met with the prosecutors from the homicide team, and they were very much convinced Jamie Letson is nothing but a braggart and lying about her involvement.
Detective Morgan has his doubts, but continues the investigation into Jamie. He contacts Dr. Cumberland, who is now the main medical examiner in the area.
If Jamie was telling the truth, time of death became the issue in the case.
The time of death didn't fit the parameters that Dr. Riddick had given at all. They were much longer. And Dr. Riddick said it was up to 20 hours. You've got to understand Dr. Riddick's reputation in this area. I mean, he is the guru of forensic pathology.
Detective Barber and Dr. Cumberland visit now-retired Dr. Riddick to examine the original calculations. Back then, Dr. Riddick had used rigor, insect activity, and body temperature to establish Catherine's time of death. In the review, they discover a file lost in the shuffle for 20 years.
Dr. Riddick, as he began going through his notes, ended up pulling out a handwritten note on a legal piece of paper from back in 1980. And it was a vitreous potassium test that they did back then.
A vitreous potassium test is yet another way of analyzing when death occurs.
In the living state, all the cells have more potassium inside the cell than they do outside. So when the body dies, the potassium slowly leaks out. Since we know what the normal level is, when the cell dies and the level starts going up, we could use that as a determination to determine the time of death.
A review of Catherine's potassium test reveals an important discrepancy, one that lines up with Jamie's confession.
When they did the vitreous potassium test, they written down that the time of death, 44 hours, plus or minus 4 hours. Dr. Riddick, when he's able to come in with his notes and said, I made an error here, that became the turning point to where time of death was changed.
The original finding of the timing of Catherine's death is now in question. The window could be much larger. Jamie could be her killer. But because so many years have passed, investigators feel they need new evidence to close the case.
We need another type of scientific backing to say that, in fact, Catherine, could her body have been out in those woods for 48 hours?
Twenty years after the murder of Catherine Foster, investigators discover a discrepancy in her time of death. Now Dr. Cumberland needs to corroborate the finding so police can charge their suspect.
University of Tennessee, Knoxville, they have a place they call the body farm. And it was perfect because here was a situation that wasn't available back in the early 80s that now they could use. They've set up an area on the outside of the city, and then officers who are trying to solve a case based on time of death, they come up to the body farm and they give them all the variables they have. And then they get a body that matches as closely as possible to the individual who died.
The body farm takes a woman's body just like Catherine's and leaves it in a forested area for 48 hours.
The wind was blowing. The blowflies just didn't get access to it like they normally would. And so as a result, there very few of them had laid their eggs. And that throws you off because if you're used to having cases where in 24 hours they're really going to town on it, and then you've got a body that's just got a few, it looks like they're just starting, then you think, ooh, it can't be that long. We keep track of it over time to see how fast the decomposition occurs and what it looks like over those time frames. And when they did that, it fit the 48 hours exactly.
Dr. Cumberland's findings now prove that Catherine was killed 2 days before she was found.
Catherine had been killed immediately from the time that she went missing, that she had been shot and killed, was actually laying in those woods the whole time. It took us going to the body farm and actually just physically looking at a body out in the woods to see that it was possible.
But there is still one other question to be resolved from the timeline in 1980. The shots that were heard on Saturday night.
The young lady in the dorm heard the two gunshots, but two security officers were on duty, and they both reported hearing what they thought was fireworks. Apparently had had some problems with kids setting off fireworks in that area.
The report of 2 a.m. gunshots is dismissed. Police confirm Jamie's confession is true.
I was at the point in my career where very few things shocked me, but I was shocked beyond belief that Jamie was the one that was responsible for Catherine's murder.
Going into this, everyone had this wonder, is it the boogeyman, somebody out of the darkness? It's not a boogeyman. It's someone who knew her. It's someone you would least expect, who was right there amongst everyone all the time.
investigators put out an arrest warrant for Jamie.
We learned that Jamie was in a halfway house. We drove to the halfway house. She was literally standing right by the driveway. I walked up to her, confirmed that she was Jamie, and we arrested her right there. And she was very emotional, actually. She even said to us that it was a little bit of a relief and that she wanted to talk to us. She wanted to tell us everything.
Jamie's motive for killing her best friend has to do with one of the original suspects in the case, Catherine's boyfriend.
Jamie actually portrayed to her family that Tom was her boyfriend. She had gotten a hold of some pictures of Tom. She showed them to her family saying this was her boyfriend. Everything that she ever did in her life became over the top obsessed with and just went to extremes about.
On January 16th, 2010, Jamie Kellum is convicted and sentenced to life in prison.
The investigation proved that she did it. The science proved that she did it. And that was more than enough for the jury. And then afterwards, being able to honestly just embrace that family and them thank you for helping provide some sort of justice for them, there's nothing like that in the world.
The job that the ME did, it was a professional, it was a complete, it was total. He did everything that he could do. The science and the diligence that was expended resulted in the ability to then get the conviction in 2010.
Catherine Foster's family, they've lost their daughter, and I suspect that even after all those years, they have not gotten beyond it. And that's weighed on their hearts all those years. Now that at least they know what happened and they have an answer, finally. You know, justice is served.